then turned serious again. "The group chief running Golf Sierra, that's the task force you've been assigned to, said his team would benefit from having a shooter who also had some first-rate tradecraft. I guess they want to use you as advance force operations, scouting out hits before the rest of the team shows, that kind of stuff."
"Right, but, again, you think this is a bad idea?"
"It's a job. Jobs come with bosses, bosses come with orders, and orders come with..."
"Bullshit?"
"Bullshit. Yes, indeed."
Maurice was almost finished with his second beer. He said,
"Hanley, he's the suit running the team. And Carmichael, he's..."
"I know who Carmichael is."
"Right. Anyway, don't trust either of them."
"Why do you say that?"
"Because I don't trust them. Good enough?"
Court started to ask for more clarification. Instead, he just shrugged.
"Good enough.
And don't trust the ISI.
Now the 25-year-old cocked his head.
"Trust Pakistani intelligence? I'm not an idiot."
"No, you're not. But our agencies do work together from time to time."
The older man made air quotes with his fingers as he said this.
"Got it.
Watch your back, son. As a singleton, you only had yourself to rely on, but that was all you needed. Now, you'll be a cog in a bigger machine. You're the best. I don't doubt that for one second. But I've lived long enough to see the best get killed, time and time again. You've grown on me over the years. I'd like to see you live to be 30.
Court stood and threw the two empty bottles in the trash.
30?
A little optimistic, aren't you?
A man can dream.
Maurice stood.
Start packing. I'm going to go outside and have a smoke. We're wheels up in 2 hours.
12. Matthew Hanley's stateside office was far away from CIA HQ, down in Virginia Beach, in a converted office complex that was guarded and gated, equipped with cameras and other security measures. His two ground branch teams each had a floor of their own, sublevel 1 and sublevel 2, but Matt's office was above ground, on the second story, along with the intelligence and logistics teams. Promptly at 9 a.m., on the fourth day after Hanley returned to the United States, his executive assistant told him someone was waiting outside to see him. He looked at his watch, appreciated the punctuality of his visitor, and stood up from his desk.
"Send her in, Leah."
A young woman entered Hanley's office wearing black slacks and a gray sweater, her dark hair back in a ponytail and simple glasses covering large brown eyes. She had dark Hispanic features and a lean frame of about 5'4". Hanley found her attractive, but dressed down and understated, and this he appreciated. He stepped around his desk. He hadn't bothered to put on his suit coat, and he hiked up his pants up a little before he came over and shook the woman's outstretched hand.
"Matt Hanley."
"Marquez, sir."
Her voice was low, serious, and professional. She looked him directly in the eyes, and this he also appreciated.
"Been reading all about you, young lady. Julia Marquez, from El Paso, Texas."
"I go by Julie, sir, and I was born in Las Cruces, New Mexico. I moved to El Paso with my family when I was 10.
"Details," Hanley said with a tired smile. "I appreciate details."
Hanley offered her a chair in front of his desk, and she sat stiffly. He returned to his own chair and plopped down.
"Former Army Specialist, 35 Foxtrot, Intelligence Analyst."
"Correct."
"I was Army myself, 5th Special Forces."
Julie Marquez said nothing. Hanley gave her a moment, then continued.
"You did 2 years with 3rd ID, just 2 years. Then you were moved into JSOC, Tactical Intelligence. That's a hell of an accomplishment. Tactical Intel for Special Operations Command at what, 21 years old?
"Correct, sir."
"Damn impressive."
Again, she just looked back at him. He waited a moment for an acknowledgement of his compliment, and then, when it did not come, he said,
"Glowing reports and accolades in your 4 years there at JSOC, and then you left the Army and worked at DIA for the past 2 years.
19 months,
she corrected. Hanley chuckled a little. Analysts could be annoyingly precise, but this one seemed downright pedantic.
Okay, 19 months. And then you left there to come work at the agency. That's a lot of moving around for a woman as young as you. How old are you again?
My DOB isn't in that file in your hand.
Hanley now wondered if this woman was being insubordinate. She was so matter-of-fact about all this. If so, it was one hell of a weird tactic for a job interview. He allowed a little of his frustration to show.
It is, Marquez, but I don't want to look down at it. I want you to tell me.
I turned 27 last Tuesday.
Well then, happy belated.
He wasn't smiling, and neither was she.
You've worked tactical, you've worked strategic. You come highly recommended. You might be a suitable fit for the position I am hiring for. What have you been told about the job?
Without hesitating, she said,
I was told SAD had an opening. My current job here at the agency is below my capabilities. A misuse of my skills. I hope this one is better.
Hanley was good at reading people. It came from his career as a spy. Marquez gave nothing away with her face. She was attentive, but unemotional.
He said, I run a task force composed of a pair of asset teams, along with their field support staff. Are you familiar with Ground Branch?
She nodded.
The paramilitary unit, basically doing what SEAL Team 6 does, what Delta does.
Hanley shrugged.
The military mission is a little different than ours, but some of the basic skill sets are the same. Anyway, we're looking for a new junior tactical field analyst in our intel shop.
Okay,
she said. Hanley couldn't tell if she wanted the job or not. He said,
I'm going to be honest with you. The position you would be filling, the last person who held it made a critical error. An error that led to the death of one of my officers.
Marquez asked,
What was the error?
He provided schematics of a facility we raided. There was a tunnel we knew nothing about. He'd had days to assess the location, a location that the U.S. military built. There was a lot of data about the site, and he assured us the blueprint he gave us was correct.
Hanley added, No tunnel on the blueprint. Marquez said,
The site was altered. The tunnel was added after the blueprints were generated.
Obviously. But it was his job to ascertain that information, or to say it was an unknown. He did neither. He signed off on the schematics, and that got a good man killed.
Julie Marquez did not reply.
Do you disagree?
I neither agree nor disagree. I could only determine if an error was made by looking at all the raw data.
Hanley leaned back in his chair now.
Would that interest you?
For the first time, Hanley saw emotion on the pretty young woman's face. He even heard a slight excitement in her voice.
I would like to examine the data and see if I would have come to a different conclusion than the previous analyst.
Good. I have a conference room with a laptop set up and all the paperwork in a file. Just down the hall, second door on the right. You have 2 hours to find out if the last guy fucked up or not.
Julie Marquez blinked now.
You fired him without knowing for sure if he made a mistake?
A man died. The analyst lost the confidence of those who have to go outside the wire. The analyst had to be removed, regardless of whether he made any error at all.
Hanley sighed.
It's a tough gig. Absolutely unforgiving. You need to be aware of that if you want to join us.
She responded in her flat tone.
Second door on the right, you said?
Hanley nodded, looked at his watch.
2 hours, and the clock is now ticking.
In the end, Marquez didn't need 2 hours. She needed 48 minutes. She stepped into Hanley's office unannounced, the laptop in her hands. When Hanley looked up at her, she declared dryly,
You were correct to move the analyst. He did make an error.
Hanley glanced down at his Tag Heuer watch.
You figured that out in 45 minutes.
I would correct you and tell you it was actually 48 minutes, but I understand some people get annoyed when I am overly specific, so that might be the wrong thing to say.
Hanley waved her comment away.
Sit down. Tell me how you could have avoided this.
Marquez sat, placing the laptop on his desk.
The schematics are of the entire compound, and the previous analyst was correct to use them, correct to cross-reference reports of U.S. personnel as well as Allied personnel to verify details. But other than running a request through NGA for any intelligence on the cluster of freestanding homes just here on the hillside to the north, and looking at the raw data of some ISR flyovers, your analyst did no more research on anything outside the compound's walls.
She looked up at him.
I would have made that a priority.
Why?
Because intel on the compound was solid and easy to obtain. Intel on the village was not. I wouldn't have gone after what was easy. I would have gone after what was difficult, because that would be the most likely threat vector to the ground branch team once they hit the location.
When Hanley did not speak, she said,
ISI would be aware that we had data on the compound. We're talking about Pakistan. The ISI is riddled with compromises. Whoever we were after at the compound could have been aware we knew our way around inside.
Hanley looked back down at the aerial photograph on the laptop. Continue.
She said, so I pulled up every single overflight of the area for the past 5 months, overlaid them on the computer, and created a sort of motion picture of the progress, focusing on the movements in the village. Look at this.
She touched a pen on the monitor, indicating a concrete blockhouse 25 meters up the hill from the north wall of the compound.
3 months ago, construction began on this structure.
She pulled up other images on different days around that time. Hanley said, trucks coming, trucks going, so?
On 7 different images, over a 2-month period, we see trucks coming up the one road out of the village or parked at the house. On 5 different overflights, we caught trucks leaving.
2 months to build this little house? That seems excessive.
Not to build it, sir. The structure was already there. No, the 2 months were spent renovating something inside the existing building.
What were the trucks bringing in?
From my calculations, looking at the imagery of the approaching vehicles, I'd say they were carrying nothing of any great weight. They were partially loaded with something, but I won't speculate. And when the trucks left, they were heavily loaded.
With?
Hanley got it now.
With dirt.
Correct. The Pakistanis were building a tunnel into and out of the compound. I saw there was a question as to why a heavy machine gun and guards had been posted at an empty facility. Perhaps it was to keep people away while the location was being altered.
And the previous analyst should have noticed this construction in town.
I guess I am not saying what he should have done, Mr. Hanley. I am saying what I would have done. It's my job to separate signal from noise, sir. That's what I do. The trucks represented an important signal as to what was going on.
Hanley nodded, impressed. If you take this job, you'll be sent all over the world. You have a husband, a family, a boyfriend who means something to you?
She answered without hesitation. No,
she said,
then pointed to the data on the laptop. This means something to me. This means everything.
Hanley smiled. You're an odd duck. You know that, Marquez?
Without showing any signs of being offended, she just shrugged and said, I'm sure all that's in my file, too.
It is. Is that going to be a problem for me if I hire you?
That's up to you. Some people find me strange, but I'm just me, and I don't see me as strange in the least.
Now the big man nodded, appreciative of the way she took his jab and turned it into his hang-up, not hers. He stood, extended a hand. The job is yours if you want it, and I sure as hell hope you want it.
Marquez herself stood now. She shook his hand. I'll take it.
13. Present day. Priyanka Bhandari had no idea how long she'd been sleeping, but a vigorous shake to her shoulder brought her to. She was helped to her feet and pushed forward, and only then did she remember that she was on an aircraft. She realized now that the plane she'd been flying on had landed, and she was escorted down the jet stairs and pushed into a waiting car. She felt incredible heat and humidity. She'd never been to Pakistan, which was where she assumed she was now, but the hot air sure felt a lot like home. She was driven for an hour, and still the music blared in her ears, until finally the car came to a stop and she was let out onto what felt and smelled like some sort of a service elevator. When it reached its destination, she had no idea how many floors she'd ascended, but she'd definitely ascended. She was led across a room or down a hallway, and then she was pushed through a door.
Here the pillowcase was removed, her headphones were yanked off, and she was shoved forward while she blinked against the sudden exposure to light. A door slammed behind her, and she found herself in a small and dingy storage space that had been set up like a cell. A cot in a corner, a bucket across from it. There was no plumbing. She assumed the bucket would be for her waste, but she didn't want to think about having to use it. She was hungry, thirsty, exhausted, and scared. But at the forefront of her mind was the worry that she would, through her actions in the next few minutes or few hours, blurt out a name that might put someone very close to her in danger. Priyanka Bhandari didn't know the identity of the man who had breached the fence of the embassy in Algiers under the watchful eye of her drone. She only knew his code name. But she did know the identity of the man who had brokered this entire operation, and this knowledge in her brain terrified her now. Sometime later, the door to her cell was opened, and a man wearing a mask entered, carrying a bottle of water, a paper plate of naan bread, and a plastic bowl of lentil soup. The bread was stale, and the soup was lukewarm, but she ate ravenously between gulps of water, consuming a fourth of her meal before the man left and locked the door behind him. She didn't know if lentil soup was popular fare in Pakistan, but it was in her own country of India, and she appreciated this taste of home, such as it was. When the masked man returned, he threw her a blue jumpsuit and told her to dress in it now, while he watched. He spoke to her in Hindi, with an Indian accent, but he was not the Indian man she'd spoken to on the aircraft.
"Why are these Indians working for Pakistan?" she wondered.
She refused at first, but he calmly explained that his orders were to check her body and her clothing for any hidden items that weren't found when she was originally taken. She remembered the GPS tracker, still affixed to the back of her neck, and she realized her best option to keep the device on her body and undetected was to comply with the man, despite the fact that this would be brutally humiliating. Still, she realized that if he could put his hands through her clothing and see her naked body from across the little cell, there was hope he wouldn't begin touching her, then feeling around in her hair, where he would certainly uncover the tracker hidden there. As she took off her clothes, she felt sickened to stand nude in front of this stranger, but also hopeful that by subjecting herself to this insult now, she would improve her chances for rescue. Once the man checked through all her clothing, he tossed it onto the floor outside the cell, again instructed her to dress in the jumpsuit, then picked up the empty plate and bowl and left without another word. Priya did as asked, then sat down in her jumpsuit on the edge of her tiny cot and tried to regain her composure. As she thought about everything she'd been through since Algiers, it slowly dawned on her that things could have easily been so much worse. She hadn't been incessantly badgered for information. She wasn't hit or manhandled past a threatening but ultimately painless hold on her throat. Other than the humiliation she just endured and the promise of bad things to come, she felt she had gotten off relatively easy. So far. An hour later, she was certain her luck was about to come to an end. She was again given the headphones and hooded before being walked out of the cell and down a corridor. She was pushed down, not roughly but firmly, into a metal chair. She was bound by a metal chain so thin it would slice into her skin if she tried to move, and it had been wrapped around her wrists and forearms a dozen times or more before she'd heard the click of a small padlock, so she didn't even bother to test its strength. Her terror regarding the entire situation had her imagining men standing right in front of her with knives, ready to plunge them into her body. It was the unknown that scared her, and deprived of most of her senses, virtually everything was an unknown right now. Finally, hands took the hood off her head and the music out of her ears. She kept her eyes closed for a moment until she heard a soft voice right in front of her. He spoke Hindi, and it sounded like the Indian from the hotel in Algiers and the same voice as the man on the plane.
"It's okay, dear. You may look at me."
She blinked her eyes open. Tears of terror had formed on her long lashes and they dripped onto her cheeks. It took a moment, but soon she focused on the man sitting before her. It was, in fact, the man from Algeria. He wore comfortable and casual clothing.
his brown silk shirt open halfway down his hairy chest. He was heavy but well-kempt, as if he'd just bathed and changed for his talk with this prisoner. He looked to Priya as if he were someone's kind and doting father. Behind him, however, there were three younger men, and they looked to Priya to be men of the street. Gangsters. Thugs. She saw the grips of handguns sticking out of belts, cold, dark eyes, and the cruel sneers of those who looked at her as if she were prey. She had been expecting a Pakistani military prison, but what she saw instead looked like members of some sort of criminal element from her home country. This made no sense. The older man smiled at her, his bushy mustache rising above white teeth.
"Young lady, you may call me Che."
She did not respond to this.
"And what shall I call you? Your phone is locked, so we must admit we know very little about you."
Finally, she spoke her first words.
Where is this place?
In the spirit of openness and truthfulness, I will tell you. We are in the heart of Mumbai. I would say you are home, but I do not know where you live. From your dialect, I detect you are from somewhere else. Goa, perhaps?
Priyanka had gone to university in Mumbai, and she lived here now, but she was in fact from Goa. She did not reveal this through words, though she wondered if she'd telegraphed it with her surprised expression. The man called Jay said,
"But wherever it is you hail from, my guess is you work in New Delhi now."
"Why New Delhi?"
"Because that is where the R&AW is headquartered. You are a field agent, I understand, but surely you see New Delhi as your home base, yes?"
R&AW was Indian Intelligence, this Priya knew, though she had no relationship with Indian Intelligence whatsoever.
"I don't work for R&AW,
the man smiled.
"That sounds just a bit like something someone who works for R&AW would say, doesn't it?"
I don't.
"Then, pretty one, who do you work for?"
She surprised herself by replying with a question of her own.
"Who do you work for?"
He smiled and spoke with pride.
"Bari."
Priya recoiled.
"Palak Bari? You are B Company?"
B Company was the most powerful mafia group in India. They had a controlling hold of vast swaths of the underworld.
"You've heard of us. Good. This might make tonight go a little quicker."
"Everyone has heard of B Company."
The man smiled, prideful still.
"That is to my advantage right now, that you know something about us. Let me tell you, young sister, that we wish you no harm at all. We only hope to learn from you about the incident last night. But before we begin with that unpleasantness, tell me about yourself."
She wanted to give this man something, but to keep it vague.
"I am no one. I just graduated from university in May."
"Congratulations," he said without smiling.
"Dhanyavad."
"Thank you," she said.
"Computer studies. I was hired by a man, I don't know who, to do a job in Algeria. It had nothing to do with India at all."
In fact, she was sure the original job had everything to do with helping India and hurting Pakistan. The fact that Indian mobsters had kidnapped her for it still had Priya perplexed. Jay nodded thoughtfully, made a show with his hands as he called for chai to be brought for both of them. She drank the hot liquid greedily, and he smiled while she sipped. Finally, as if he were in no hurry, he said,
"I need the name of the man who hired you. Perhaps you are who you say you are. Perhaps you are not a spy." He winked. "But I think you are a spy."
"I am not a spy. My employer is not a spy. We only take technical jobs."
"On behalf of India's intelligence service?"
"No."
The man looked at her a long time, then said,
"Do you know why you have been so well-treated over the past day?"
When she didn't answer, he said,
"You must be wondering this."
I don't know."
"Because we think you are R&AW. We, I am speaking of myself and the others here and of my entire organization. We do not have any problems hurting people when we have no choice but to hurt people. But we do our best not to bring the Indian federal government down upon us if we can avoid it. We are not your enemy, young lady, unless you make that inevitable.
Priya said nothing.
You were caught supporting a foreign intelligence operation that would have benefited India. That sounds like the research and analysis wing to me. In fact, that's the only thing it sounds like.
She shrugged.
I was not told who we were targeting other than the Turkish embassy in Algiers. My job was to watch over things.
So that an infiltrator could break in.
I didn't know about any infiltrator. I flew the drone.
He shook his head. For the first time, he showed that he was annoyed with her, and that uneased her some, almost as if she were disappointing a relative and not pissing off a gangster.
Che said, "The communications gear in your hotel room. You were in contact with someone on the ground."
"I..."
"And your drones had thermal imaging. There was a man on the property. You saw him. You talked to him. Denying it will only anger us."
He smiled a little.
"Listen, we are all just doing a job. I do not hate you for doing yours, and I hope you do not hate me for doing mine."
"No, sir. I don't hate anyone."
"We are both Indian. I have every intention of being nice to you. You tell me what you know, and this is all over for you. You will be treated well and released unharmed."
He leaned closer.
"I do not wish to threaten you with my actions."
Priya was anticipating a but.
"But," the man said, "just like you work for someone, I work for someone."
Gravely, he said,
"Someone in Pakistan."
He let the comment hang in the air.
"The Pakistani is on his way here now, only a few hours from arrival. We both know that if he has to come here with his people to get information from you, he will not hesitate to use any tool at his disposal."
"But I don't know anything."
Jay's face darkened for a second time, and Priya began to wonder if the entire friendly disposition was merely some sort of an interrogation technique, a facade that would soon disappear. In a voice lower and more serious than before, he said,
"You know how to get into your phone, now don't you?"
Priya looked at the floor in front of her for a moment. What could she possibly say? Finally, she looked up.
"I can't tell you."
Jay nodded, sadness on his face.
"Our agreement with our business partners in Pakistan is that we ourselves will do nothing against our own nation that will bring the weight of the government down upon our enterprise."
He shrugged.
"If you are, in fact, Indian intelligence, then torturing you for the information we seek would be very much against our own nation."
He sat back in his chair.
"But if you are, as you say, just a recent university graduate who happened to be caught working in Algeria, then we could do with you whatever we wanted. The government won't care if you simply disappear."
She trembled but remained silent. He leaned forward.
"Now, very carefully answer this one question. Do you, or do you not, work for the research and analysis wing?"
He was imploring her to confirm that she worked for RNAW, whether it was true or not, because he did not want to torture her himself. Tears filled Priyanka's eyes. She did not know what to say, finally. With a little nod, she lied.
"I do."
Jay put his hands on his knees and then stood.
"You have bought yourself a little time, young lady. But you have also brought yourself immeasurable pain for not giving us the information we seek. The Pakistani will come here. He will get what he wants from you, and I am terribly concerned that he will not allow you to leave with your life. My organization will have nothing to do with this. We aren't killing RNAW officers. But it won't matter to you, because you will be just as dead when this is all over.
Priya Bhandari began sobbing uncontrollably as the big man left the room. 14. 12 years ago. The handoff of the new ground branch asset happened in a parking lot at Dulles International Airport, surrounded by tourists and business travelers. Maurice Cahill led Court Gentry out of the terminal, both men carrying duffel bags, towards a broadly built and middle-aged man in a gray suit standing next to a black Yukon XL. A younger man was behind the wheel of the vehicle. A third man in a suit stood near the big man. Court took the middle-aged guy to be an agency exec and the other two to be bodyguards, but he had no idea why an SAD executive would need security while stateside. That said, he'd heard that the ground branch guys could be wired a little tight, unable to leave the enemy theater behind, even when they left the enemy theater behind. As the two men just off the plane walked towards the Yukon, Court spoke softly to Maurice.
I guess this is goodbye. Any last words of wisdom for me?
Same as ever, kid. Don't get got.
Court smiled a little.
Same as ever.
At the Yukon, Maurice said,
Court Gentry, this is Matthew Hanley. Matt has made quite a name for himself since moving to the agency from the Army. Currently, he's group chief of an SAD task force, and he'll be your new boss.
Court and Matt shook hands, though Hanley looked at Court with no small amount of skepticism. He even flashed his eyes towards Maurice, an obvious show of confusion. Court Gentry did not look like a ground branch asset, and he knew it. He'd shaved his face clean, though his hair was a little long, and for today's meeting he wore a tie and a blazer. Court understood he was here to join a team of paramilitary operations officers, but he imagined he wouldn't be climbing off the flight from Minsk and heading directly to some rifle range to shoot machine guns. This was the CIA. He figured there would be meetings, paperwork, bullshit. And he was dressed like the suits he imagined he'd encounter today. His entire modus operandi was built on fitting in, not standing out. Being invisible. Living gray. Matt Hanley thanked Maurice perfunctorily. Court said his goodbyes to his mentor with a quick handshake and brief eye contact that to both men reflected back to the 2 years they'd spent together. And then the big SAD executive led Court to the back seat of the Yukon, putting Court's lone piece of luggage, a tan duffel bag, into the SUV himself. Hanley sat next to Court and spoke to him as the vehicle began rolling.
Murmansk. That was some wild shit. I'd love to hear the real story.
Me too,
Court replied dryly. Hanley wasn't code-worded into that op, so, new boss or not, Court wasn't talking. Hanley chuckled, and he didn't press. He said,
I don't know if you had some fantasy that you'd be heading into HQ. By the way you're dressed, I'm assuming that to be the case. We aren't going to Langley. We're heading to a facility we have down in Virginia Beach. You'll meet other members of the task force there, and...
Hanley looked Court up and down.
We'll see what we're going to do with you.
Court nodded and just looked out the window. He'd not been back to the United States in over a year, and then it was just for some specialized classes at CIA's training center in Harvey Point. The last time he'd spent any meaningful time in the United States, he was preparing to go into the field as a singleton operative in the Autonomous Asset Program. To be cut free of the tether of the agency and communicate with HQ only sporadically, to get intelligence or mission directives. He'd gone native to some degree in the past 4 years, Court decided, while looking at the Virginia countryside around him. It didn't feel like home. It didn't look like home. It occurred to him that he probably shouldn't get too used to it even now, since Ground Branch was always jetting around the world running various ops. Virginia Beach was just a stop along the way to some armpit of the earth where he and a group of hard dudes would go and kill people. He put all the unknowns out of his mind. As soon as Hanley began sending texts on his phone, ignoring his new asset, Court put his head against the window of the Yukon and fell asleep. They passed through the high, barbed wire-rimmed gate of a well-protected office building just before lunchtime and parked in front of the main entrance. Hanley handed Court his duffel and led him inside, perfunctorily flashing his credentials to multiple layers of security. They entered an elevator, and the task force leader pressed the button that read U2, which told Court his new workplace would be 2 stories below ground. As the elevator began descending, Hanley turned to the younger man.
Here's what you need to know before we go in. The TL of Golf Sierra is Hightower. He's as good as they come. We got him a few years ago from SEAL Team 6, and he was pretty much a legend there.
Court said nothing, although the phrase whoop-de-doo was going through his head.
But Zack can be... he can be resistant to authority. I don't mean he won't execute any mission he's given, just that he can show a certain obstinance about things, a disagreeableness. He'll come along if managed correctly, but it takes work to deal with Zack Hightower.
My team leader is a whiny asshole. Great,
Court thought, but he just said,
Why are you telling me this, sir?
Because you need to be ready if he doesn't greet you with a big hug and flowers. He knows nothing about you at all, just that you've been assigned to his outfit. He doesn't get a say in the matter. You can quit if you can't hack it, but he can't fire you without going through me and Carmichael first. You can imagine what that might be like for an alpha male who is responsible for executing difficult missions while keeping the men under him alive.
And with that, the elevator lurched to a stop and the doors opened. A tall man with short blonde hair and a bushy beard stood feet in front of them in a small and otherwise empty entry hallway. His body was squared off to the elevator, and his hands were on his hips. It was an aggressive posture. While Gentry wore a blue blazer, a burgundy tie, khakis, and dress shoes, the man before him was dressed in a flannel shirt, jeans, and dirty roper boots. He was nearly 4 inches taller than Court, probably 15 years older, with shoulders several inches broader. He didn't seem to wear an ounce more fat on his frame than was necessary to keep him functional, and his steely gray eyes bored into Court, then into Hanley, and finally back to Court. The two men stepped off the elevator, and Hanley said,
Zack, meet your new six. This is Gentry.
Looking to Court, he said,
This is Hightower, Sierra One.
Court extended a hand, but Hightower did not. He just glanced Hanley's way with an angry look on his face.
Is this a joke?
Court lowered his hand. Hanley did not answer, so Hightower added,
Is it bring your kid to work day, Matt? Is that it?
He turned back to Court.
What are you, 17?
Court's jaw muscles flexed, and he barked out a reply.
Nailed it. How old are you? 50?
Court didn't think Zack looked 50, but he didn't think he looked 17 either.
Prior service? Hightower asked Court. I've been in operations for almost 6 years, 2 in training, 4 in the field. I'm asking about your military service history.
No.
No what?
No, I'm not former military.
Sierra One cocked his head and looked at Court with bewilderment. After a time, he turned to Hanley.
Matt, can I talk to you in private?
Hanley sighed, but Court got the distinct impression the task force leader was not in the least bit surprised about his team leader's reaction. The two men stepped through a door after Hanley asked Court to wait in the hallway. He found a bench and sat down, and he caught himself wishing he were back in Sloanheim, or St. Petersburg, or Moscow, or Budapest, or anywhere else, preparing for his next job. Alone. Hanley shut the door to the floor's small break room and stepped in a few feet deeper towards a row of tables, so Gentry couldn't hear what he expected to be a heated discussion, and Hightower didn't let him down.
Seriously, Matt? You send me some ass clown from D.O. who never served in the military, who looks like he should be taking my niece to prom, and I'm supposed to turn him into a Tier 1 operator?
Nobody's asking you to train him. He already is a Tier 1 operator.
How the fuck so, boss? He plays Xbox between his dead drops? That make him an operator? Or is he running around the woods with the airsoft kids when he's not chatting up the Chinese attaché at a cocktail party?
He's not that kind of operations guy. That's all I know.
Before Hightower could speak, Matt added,
Denny Carmichael vouched for this man. I know you don't exactly walk the halls of the 7th floor, Zack, so I'll remind you. Denny is the director of the Special Activities Division. I work for him. You work for me. And now, because Denny and I have spoken, Violator works for you.
Violator?
Sorry, that was his code name in D.O.
Hightower just shook his head at the insanity of this.
What kind of stupid-ass code name is...
Look, he's your new six. You don't have to like it, you don't have to understand it, but that's the way it is. You can't say no. But if he quits, that's on him. If he quits, we'll go looking for someone else.
Hanley could see the sudden spark in Hightower's eyes, and he knew instantly that Gentry had a very difficult day in store, because Hightower would try his best to force the young man to quit. But Zack wasn't finished with his arguing.
Have you ever heard of anyone joining Ground Branch as an operator without serving in the military?
Hanley thought a minute, then nodded.
Jeff Russell. Used to be an X-ray Charlie. No former military service.
Hightower waved a dismissive hand.
Russell was a cop in Oakland, then made federal SWAT, then FBI HRT, then CIA in the DO.
He motioned in the direction of the younger man sitting on the bench outside the room.
You gonna tell me your Wonder Boy was on the FBI's hostage rescue team before turning into some secret squirrel for the agency?
No, I'm not saying that. I don't know what he was doing before he joined DO.
Hightower shouted now.
He was a fucking middle schooler before he joined DO!
Hanley ignored the outburst.
And I don't know what he was while he was in the DO. I just know Carmichael wants you to integrate him.
Hanley thought a moment before saying,
I am aware of an operation last year in Russia, and I've been told this asset carried out that operation alone. If that is true, then he's all the six you need, Zack.
Being a little vague, aren't you, boss?
It was a code word op, but I picked up some of the deets from open source after the fact. Denny says Violator pulled it off single-handedly.
Quickly, he added, but that's between you and me. That's not for dissemination to the boys. Hightower clearly knew when he was beat. This wasn't Hanley's doing, so Hanley wouldn't be able to undo it.
What do I do with him?
Hanley said.
Take him down to U3. Gear him up with Sims. See how he works with the team. If he can't stack up and run clean with you guys, keep at it. If he throws in the towel, then call me and we'll talk. Come on, Zack. You've dealt with new blood before.
Hightower's eyes grew distant and his face turned to steel.
Yes, sir, I have. In fact, this is my third time in 5 months. I've been covered in new blood recently.
He was clearly furious, but Hanley had been a military officer, then a CIA officer. He had given the order that was given to him, and he didn't give a shit if this man liked the order or not. He turned back to the door, opened it, and beckoned the younger man in. As Gentry entered, he spoke matter-of-factly.
You guys might want to work on soundproofing these walls just a tad.
Hanley didn't acknowledge this. He said,
Okay, I know how this is gonna go. You two have to do a little butt-sniffing to see who the pack leader is here. Well, Gentry, the answer is this. It's Hightower. I don't know or care what you did before today. You are a soldier in his unit. What he says goes, full stop. You got that?
Court spoke softly.
Got it, sir.
Hanley turned to Hightower.
Now bring your men in.
Hightower went to a door on the opposite wall and opened it.
On me, guys.
Court watched as four men entered. They were older than Court, bigger, more muscular, and all dressed in casual attire. Three were wearing ball caps, two wore flip-flops. An African-American had a freshly clean-shaven face, but the other three wore beards and mustaches. They looked at Court, then at their TL. None of them seemed to get that Court was now part of their unit. Hightower motioned to the African-American.
Gentry, this is Lennox, Golf Sierra 2. Morgan is 3, Pace here is 4, and Redis 5. Gents, this here is the fucking new guy. Our overlords, in their infinite wisdom, have determined that young Mr. Gentry will be our new Sierra 6. We're gonna run him and see what he's made of.
The fuck?
Muttered Redis, a tall, dark-complected 38-year-old wearing a Sammy Hagar t-shirt and flip-flops. Hanley apparently was done with all this.
I've got to haul ass up to Langley for a meeting at 3.
He turned to Hightower.
Figure this out, Zack. Call me later.
Right, boss.
When Hanley was back in the elevator, Hightower looked Court over, then at the duffel on his shoulder.
That all your shit?
Yeah.
Take it down the hall, second room on the right. That's your temporary hooch. Don't unpack, you won't be staying. But do change out of that monkey suit. Don't know what you've been told about Ground Branch, but we don't lunch at Capitol Grill. We're going downstairs.
What's downstairs?
Our armory and shoot house.
Cool.
Hanley says if I can get you to quit, then I don't have to keep you.
I won't quit.
Hightower eyed the younger man when he said this.
Why do you want to be on this team so bad?
Court held the bigger man's eye contact.
I don't. I don't want to be on your team. I've been here for 5 minutes and I can tell you guys are a bunch of arrogant dickheads. I just don't quit.
Morgan sniffed out a laugh.
I've heard that shit before.
That you're arrogant dickheads?
Court deadpanned. Morgan smiled.
All the time, slick.
Hightower started moving for the stairs.
Let's go shoot some people.
15. Present day. Court gentry had flown from Algiers to Istanbul, mainly because that was the first international flight of the day. Upon landing in Turkey, he took out Copper's watch and pulled up the GPS tracking app. Her tracker wasn't broadcasting, which meant either she was in the air, or else the device had been found on her body and destroyed, in which case the young Indian woman would more than likely be found floating in a river in Pakistan. He shook off this thought, told himself he just had to wait a few hours, so he found a quiet corner in the airport, settled in with some food and coffee, and focused on recharging the woman's watch and his phone. An hour later, he walked the shops in the airport, bought new clothes, toiletries, and tech gear, and cleaned himself and shaved in a bathroom. He exited looking like a new man. Minutes later, he felt a vibration in his breast pocket. It was Copper's watch, and it was notifying him that the tracker was transmitting again. He yanked it from his pocket and zoomed in carefully on the location. He blinked a few times to make sure he wasn't seeing things, and then he all but lunged for his cell phone. A minute later, Arjun answered.
Cobalt, is that you? Have you found her?
Yeah, she's in Mumbai.
Mumbai?
The man sounded genuinely astonished.
I'm in Mumbai. What's she doing in...
Court interrupted Arjun with the same question.
Why would Pakistanis take her to India, Arjun?
I don't know. I certainly didn't kidnap my employee to bring her home.
He thought a moment.
Maybe you were wrong. Maybe it wasn't Pakistani intelligence.
Court ignored the man and said,
She's at the airport. Looks like she came in on a private charter flight.
I have friends at the fixed operating bases there. I'll reach out to them.
Court was certain Arjun was a former intelligence man himself, so he suspected he had contacts all over, though he doubted they would be friends. He also suspected he wouldn't learn much at a fixed operating base. If the ISI was operating in India, they sure as hell would have a plan to cover themselves. Arjun said,
You must come to Mumbai immediately. You must help me get her back.
Court just said,
I didn't think I understood what the hell was going on before, but if she's with Murad Khan in Mumbai, then I'm really confused.
I know people all over the city. If they take her somewhere, and if you see that on the tracking monitor, just tell me, and I will find out what I can.
Don't expect to hear from me till I arrive. I don't want you trying anything without me. If someone goes in to get her, it's going to be me.
I agree, but I can arrange men to help.
I'll let you know,
Court said, and he hung up. He checked the closest departures board, scanning it as quickly as he could, hoping like hell there was a direct flight to Mumbai and that he hadn't missed it. To his relief, he saw a Turkish Airlines direct flight that was leaving in just a few hours. He'd need a visa to get into India, so he cleared Turkish customs and immigration with his forged credentials and jumped into a cab to head to the Indian embassy here in Istanbul. There, he talked his way into a tourist visa for same-day travel with no issues, and he booked his flight online while riding in another cab that raced through the city's crazy afternoon traffic. A one-way trip for a tourist would have raised eyebrows at immigration to India, so he paid for a round trip, returning to Istanbul in 6 days. He had no intentions of being on that return flight. He hoped he'd be able to free Copper from her captors, then either find Khan himself or at least find out where he'd gone. Court fully expected to end up in Pakistan hunting Murad Khan before this was all over. Again. Khan was behind Copper's kidnapping, but he couldn't imagine that Khan was actually with Copper in India right now. It made no sense for a senior ISI officer who had been declared dead by both his own agency and the CIA to be walking around in a country that was, for all intents and purposes, enemy territory. The conflict between Pakistan and India was at one of its lowest points these days, even considering the three wars that had been fought between the two nations since the 1940s. No, Copper's arrival in India made no sense to him, but he kept monitoring the tracker, and by the time he checked in for his flight to India, he saw that the GPS was indicating it had been stationary for several hours at a location at the Andheri East neighborhood of Mumbai. Court didn't know Arjun well enough to trust him with this information. While he'd love to have help surveilling the location for hours in advance of his arrival, Court decided he'd keep this intel to himself and only reveal it to Arjun when he had established himself in Mumbai. He boarded a Boeing 777 and took his seat in coach, tucking himself in with reading material he'd downloaded on his phone about Pakistan and the ISI. Maps and history and flowcharts of government organizations. A long time ago, this had been very much on his radar, but in the past decade, he'd not kept up with what was happening in Pakistan, though what had happened in Pakistan never seemed to leave his thoughts for long. The aircraft took off and banked to the south over the Sea of Marmara, banked again to the southeast, and Court kept reading, telling himself he needed to be ready for whatever he encountered at his destination, because right now, everything that had happened in the past day seemed like such a confounding and impenetrable riddle. 16. 12 years ago. A half hour after Court Gentry was told he'd get a trial run in the Ground Branch Shoot House in the basement of the Virginia Beach compound, he was decked out in body armor, a helmet, and an Avon C-50 gas mask. Just like the other men, he carried a rifle and a pistol loaded with simmunitions, actual bullets filled with a dusty paint in a plastic capsule that, when fired from these specially modified weapons, struck their targets at 700 feet a second and were known to cause cuts and heavy bruises, along with the telltale splatter of a paint round. Court had been shot thousands of times with sims while working at his father's law enforcement training facility, and he knew getting hit in the chest, face, or head where he was most protected by armor, a rubber mask, or a helmet, was far superior to taking a hit to the legs or arms. He also knew that knowledgeable shooters using sims liked to aim for their opponent's crotch. The sting of a plastic projectile to the balls could bring a man to his knees and keep him there. So Court pulled a folded hand towel from a shelf of gun cleaning products in the armory, then slipped it down his pants, with half of its length going down one leg and the remainder going down the other. This would blunt the impacts to his privates or inner thighs, should he catch around there. Even at his relatively young age, Court Gentry had more close quarters battle training than most anyone else on Earth, but one thing he did not have a lot of experience with was working in a stack, being one man in a group taking down targets. Sure, as a trainer in his father's firearm school, he had taught the techniques from time to time, but that had been 7 years ago, and even then, he was much more comfortable playing the lone wolf opposition force member than he was telling FBI hostage rescue men with decades of SWAT experience how to flood a room together and take down a target. Court figured these Ground Branch guys, while all clearly douchebags, at least would be damn good at functioning as a cohesive unit, and Court didn't have as much confidence in his own abilities to integrate. Despite Court's bluster about never quitting, Hightower might have been right. There might be no need for him to unpack his gear in his room, because this could turn into a short stay if he couldn't prove himself as adequate. The six men left the armory and walked down the hall to a door with a sign that read, "Shoot House, Live Fire, Ear and Eye Protection Mandatory. Anyone entering the door will follow the instructions of the range safety officer." The team encountered the safety officer waiting for them in the front lobby of the shoot house, a barrel-chested man of about 60, who appeared to be a grizzled former Marine gunnery officer right out of Central Casting. He checked each man's weapons, then frisked them from top to bottom to ensure that only simmunition rounds were being used during the upcoming evolutions. A metal staircase led to a catwalk above the shoot house proper, and from here, the safety officer could watch the action in each room and hallway. Because while there were walls and floors in the various spaces, there were no ceilings to block the view from the catwalk. Five other men were also in the lobby out front waiting, sitting around on a bench and geared up for a fight. Hightower explained to Court that they were all ex-Ground Branch operators who now worked in the training cadre, and they would serve as the OP4, the opposition force. The five older but obviously strong and capable former operators had already been frisked and armed with submachine guns, and soon they walked through the main shoothouse door, disappearing into the warren of rooms and hallways that made up the facility. Zack looked at Court now.
Tell me you have operated in a stack before.
I have, Court said, but it's been a minute.
Zack shrugged.
All right then, Rambo. Stack up.
Court started to put himself in the middle of the row of men standing by the entrance to the shoot house, but the African-American introduced as Lennox pushed him towards the front of the pack.
Fresh meat goes to the front.
With a shrug, he said,
sucks to be the six.
Court pushed ahead and found his place, with all five men behind him. A few seconds later, he felt a squeeze on his shoulder telling him to breach, and he tried the latch on the door. Finding it unlocked, he entered the lighted space, a small entry hall. He could feel the others tight behind him as he looked through the EOTech optic on his weapon, and he cleared the space before him. This done, he started to move to a door on the left, but a hand grabbed the drag handle on his body armor and yanked him roughly back to the right, towards another door. The team wasn't using radios. There were hand movements and other signals for small teams in close quarters battle, and Hightower wanted to be sure Gentry knew at least this much. Court moved into the first room and cut hard to the left, his weapon lights strobing through the darkness as he dug his hard corner. Finding it clear, he turned to the center of the room, the blaze of white revealing a man who was well covered behind a plywood bar area. He fired a burst, striking the wall just above the man's head.
Shit!
He went to follow up, sensing the rest of the team flowing into the room around him, but before he had a chance, rough hands shoved him out of the way.
Stay in your fucking lane!
Others in the stack engaged the man, so Court shifted aim towards a dark open room on his left. He flashed his light again and saw nothing in this space, but he knew he had to clear it quickly, because a hallway fed into the barroom he now stood in from a far corner, and if the opposition put a man in both the hall and the dark room to the left, they could pin the Gulf Sierra unit tightly together by the bar and pick them off one by one. Court broke left, rushing towards the dark room with his weapon sweeping in front of him. He didn't know it, but no one followed. Court blasted his light on the dead space to his left as he entered, and first detected the telltale outline of a man's elbow. From the position of the extremity, the man connected to it was tight against a wall and holding something in his arm. Court launched through the air to his right, fired his HK while doing so, and when he landed on the floor, he rolled onto his shoulder, ending up in a crouch with his rifle still aimed in and firing at the enemy. The opposition player crouched in the corner took one to the arm and then two to the mask, and he dropped his rifle to his chest and held up his hands, a look of astonishment on his face that he had somehow missed a target he'd had the drop on.
Hit!
The man announced. Just then, gunfire erupted back in the room where Court had left the rest of the team. As he rushed in that direction to support them, he saw Redis already down on the ground in the middle of the space. Morgan crawled forward on his knee pads and grabbed Redis's drag handle on the upper back of his body armor, but Morgan took a string of hits in the leg and right side. He went down as well, falling next to Redis and raising a hand, shouting,
"Hit!"
in the process. Hightower was behind the bar with Pace, and the origin of the fire was the open corner feeding hallway on Court's left. Court sprayed the remainder of his mag up the hall as he ran out of the dark room and back into the bar area. Then he executed another roll and came up behind Hightower behind the bar.
Reloading!
Hightower rose high on his knees to shoot over the bar, and as soon as he did so, he caught a round in the top of his mask, right on his forehead. He fell back onto his butt and sat there, out of the fight. He yelled loud enough to be heard by the man who'd tagged him.
I'm hit!
Court stopped working the reload on his rifle, let it hang on his chest, and drew his Glock pistol. Dropping down onto his left shoulder, he had a low angle on the hallway and only his head and gun arm exposed. An Op-4 player showed just a few inches of his knee as he hugged the wall at the corner, and Court shot him in the center of it. The pain of the paint round caused the man to lose his balance and expose more of his body as he fell, but Court did not fire on him. He waited for another opposition player to come retrieve his fallen man. When an ambulatory Op-4 exposed his arm to grab the drag handle on the back of his fallen partner's body armor, Court tagged him in the forearm. Court then redirected his aim to the man lying on his back, shooting him twice in the face mask now.
Hit!
The man called. The 25-year-old CIA operations officer rolled out into the middle of the barroom for an angle on the man who'd been shot in the arm. Court placed two perfect rounds in the center of the man's chest while fully prone. The opposition player fell to the ground and announced he was hit, and then Jim Pace, the only other member of Golf Sierra still operational, leapt over the bar and moved to the edge of the hallway in search of the last enemy. Court holstered his pistol, reloaded his rifle, then moved to assist his surviving teammate, but Pace didn't wait for him. He instead dropped to a knee, leaned into the hallway, and began spraying automatic weapon fire. Within seconds, Court heard a man shout from far up the dark hallway, "Hit!" The safety officer above the catwalk spoke into a wireless mic on his vest tied into the facility's PA system.
"Ceasefire! Ceasefire! God damn it!"
Morgan shouted from the floor when it was all over. Pace was no more pleased than Morgan.
"Four men down in the first fucking room! This is some amateur hour bullshit!"
Court safed his weapon, took off his mask, and wiped sweat from his forehead. He had a strong suspicion he was about to get blamed for this mess. He was not wrong. Hightower climbed back to his feet from behind the bar and stuck a finger in Court's face.
"Never go into a room alone! That fuck-up is on you! You don't leave the stack without being ordered to leave the stack! Ever!"
"I saw the room on the left and..."
The safety officer had watched the entire evolution from the catwalk. He shouted into his mic now, his gravelly Marine Corps voice booming against the walls.
"And you cover it, but you don't enter till the stack is with you! You left your team. Redis realized your mistake, and he broke off to try to support you, but he had to enter the line of fire from the far hallway. He caught a round from one of the shooters there. Morgan went to drag him back to the bar, and then he got popped because he was exposed. Zack and Pace made it to the bar, but by the time you got back to them, you had three operators pinned in an 8-foot space with no egress, and then Hightower took a round trying to cover your mag change."
Zack Hightower said,
"You break from the stack, and the stack breaks down. You got that, Gentry?"
"Got it,"
the younger man replied, chastened. Pace stepped up to Court now. He was covered in perspiration due to the exertion, all the gear, and the gas mask he'd just removed.
"Are we gonna run this again, asshole? Or are you going to admit this shit isn't for you?"
Court looked him in the eye.
"We're gonna run it again,"
Hightower said.
"You're wasting our time, kid."
Court turned to him, moved close.
"Then why am I the only one who doesn't look like an Andy Warhol painting? Bet against me. That'll be fun."
Hightower looked at the younger man with derision, but nevertheless he glanced up to the safety officer and nodded. The safety officer took the TL's cue.
"Reload, hydrate, and get set for another run."
The second run wasn't much better than the first. Court's inability to see the men behind him caused him to misjudge the speed at which they moved, and twice he was grabbed and yanked back, encouraged to slow down by Redis Sierra 5. The third time, the man in the train behind him let him go. Court got too far ahead and turned a corner into a hail of gunfire. He'd expected his team to be on his heels, but he was wrong. He shot two of the oppo, but a third took Court out with a round to the neck that hit right below his full face mask and hurt like hell. Hightower called a ceasefire, and the men again took off their masks and stood in the middle of the hall under the catwalk and under the disapproving eyes of the safety officer. Court rubbed his neck and coughed. Hightower said,
"Okay, we tried. We're done. This isn't for you, Gentry. Time for you to ring the bell."
Ring the bell was Navy SEAL speak. It meant it was time for him to give up. Court's head hung low. He couldn't argue that he'd been at the center of the failures of both evolutions. Part of him wanted to throw in the towel, but he was telling the truth when he said he didn't quit. He had to convince Sierra 1 to grant him one more try. The men around him began removing their gear. Court ignored the pain in his neck, looked to Hightower, and said,
"I have an idea. Don't integrate me with you. Stand down the oppo and let me take their place."
Hightower said,
"The oppo? You want to be part of the oppo?"
"No, I want to be the entirety of the oppo."
"You want us to come at you? All of us?"
"Yes."
"At the same time?"
Court nodded. The rest of the team laughed, save for Redis, who just spit on the sawdust-covered concrete floor and began reloading his rifle.
"The new kid wants to play op for. 5-on-1.
Hightower addressed Court.
What will that prove?
That he's a cocky prick, Pace blurted.
But let's do it anyway. I'm gonna shoot this dude in the nuts for ruining what was supposed to be a perfectly lazy afternoon.
Court implored Hightower now.
What do you have to lose? You guys are so obviously hot shit, this should be easy, right?
Court took his rifle off its sling and handed it over to Lennox.
I'll run with pistol only.
Lennox looked up at the safety officer.
This motherfucker's insane.
The older safety officer just said,
If you boys haven't been keeping score, the new kid has zipped 5 out of 10 of the oppo on the 2 runs. He's sloppy as shit with his team movement, but he's stacking bodies, and if you can't see that, you're blind.
He added,
He's not going to make it into golf, Sierra. I'll go on record with that right now, but he's a hell of a lot of fun to watch.
He nodded to Zack.
Let's see him work on his own, just for fun.
Hightower reluctantly agreed.
Fine.
To Court, he said.
We'll run the exercise against you, just so you can't go back to Hanley whining that we didn't give you every chance. But you can have a carbine, an SMG, whatever you want. We will be fully kitted up. You do not want to face us with a pistol.
All I want is a handgun. You guys have a Walther PPQ in the armory?
Court asked. Hightower replied.
You have a Glock on your hip. I prefer the...
I don't give a shit what you prefer,
Hightower said.
We all use the G19. You will use the G19, and you will like it.
Fair enough,
Court said. He'd always preferred Walther's and HK pistols to Glocks, but he wasn't going to fight this battle right now. He said,
Give me a couple of minutes, and then raid the shoot house. Let's see what you guys can do.
Pace stepped up to him.
You're dead, fuckface. You realize that, right?
Court put his mask back on.
When I'm looking down at you on the floor in 5 minutes, that's me awaiting your apology.
Pace moved closer, aggressively, but Hightower just barked his name.
Jim!
Sierra 4 stopped, eyed Court a moment more, then turned away and began moving back to the front of the shoot house lobby with the other men, while the safety officer on the catwalk looked to Gentry.
3 minutes and I'm sending them in.
He turned away, then began walking back towards the beginning of the warren of rooms. As he did so, he muttered one word that Court could hear down below.
Dumbass.
17. Hightower and his men stood outside a different entrance to the shoot house now, readying themselves for the evolution to come. The team leader spoke softly.
Morgan, you take point. Listen up, don't get cocky. Hanley said this dude had some skills, and the safety officer's right, he can shoot. We haven't seen anything all that special yet, but don't make yourself be the one that proves he's the real deal. I do not need the aggravation of running drills with this kid all day. I've got shit to do.
Morgan said,
Fuck this guy. Let's hit this door, find that squirrely little bastard and smoke him, and then go get some lunch.
Hightower said,
Nice and slow.
Keith, hit it. Morgan reached for the door latch. The ground branch team breached the side door of the shoot house, then cleared the first 3 rooms without incident. At a T intersection at the end of a hall, Hightower signaled for Golf Sierra 4 to follow him to the right, while 2, 3, and 5 went to the left. This was a departure in tactics from their earlier evolutions, but that was also the point. Zack didn't want Gentry to know what to expect, so he made the call to split the force. Jim Pace came to the first open doorway and spun in expertly, and then he kept moving, making way for Hightower to follow him in. They split at the entrance. Pace went left, and Hightower shifted right. They found the small room clear. Just as they began to restack to move back into the hallway, the sound of simmunitions fire came from the direction the other men had split off to. Pace knelt down low, then took a quick peek around the corner of the door that led into the hall. After looking down to the far end, he yanked his head back to safety and then used hand motions to convey what he saw to his Sierra 1. Lennox, Redis, and Morgan were all down in the hallway in front of an open doorway some 30 yards away. Hightower had been crouching, but he stood up slowly, dumbfounded. He headed towards the hall, then peeked out for himself. His 3 men sat with their rifles in their laps, their backs to the wall of the hallway and facing the last doorway on the left. They'd all been killed, either in the doorway itself or outside in the hall, and Hightower couldn't envision one man accomplishing that. The safety officer was on the catwalk right over the fallen men, looking down at them. Hightower turned to Pace, said nothing, just indicated with his hands that they would proceed down the hall, and then he would make a left at the T and approach the room Gentry had been shooting from via another route, while Pace himself would continue down the hall, past his fallen teammates, and hit the room simultaneous with Hightower's arrival. 1 minute later, Pace stepped over the bodies of his three teammates, keeping his weapon high, only lowering it to shield it from anyone in the room on the left. He put his shoulder on the wall near the doorway, then spun into the room, raising the gun to bring the holographic weapon sight to his eye. At first he saw nothing, but then Gentry appeared, upside down, a few feet above and in front of him. Before Pace could shift fire to the figure above him, Court shot him twice in the chest, knocking him back out into the hallway.
"Hit!"
Pace shouted as he fell onto his back, right on top of his three teammates. Court's legs were hooked around a steel beam that ran along the bottom of the catwalk over the room. He continued aiming his pistol at the doorway while still hanging upside down by his legs, but only for an instant, because he heard a noise on his right. He'd seen the closed door there when he entered, but he hadn't had time to check where it led before the first three men closed on his position. The door opened, Court shifted his pistol to the movement and fired but missed. Zack Hightower lay on the floor, rolling into the doorway on his left shoulder and firing a spray of fully automatic fire, tagging Court multiple times and causing him to fall from the beam down to the concrete. Court stood up and holstered. His left side was riddled with fresh welts and racked with pain. He ignored Zack now, stepped out into the hall, looked down at Pace, and smiled. He didn't expect an apology from the man and wasn't particularly disappointed when no apology was forthcoming. Instead, the man on the floor said,
"That's some fucking epic beginner's luck. Won't happen again."
Zack walked up to Court now, while the other men climbed back to their own feet. Court had not taken down the entire ground branch unit by himself, but he had eliminated 4 out of 5. The men were quieter than before, their bemused faces now masks of anger and frustration. Zack ordered everyone to reset, and he handed a pair of Glock magazines to Gentry.
"We'll go again,"
Hightower said, determination in his voice and on his face.
"Thought we might," Court quipped.
Pace moved up into his face now and repeated himself.
"It won't happen again."
But it did, in fact, happen again. On the second run-through, Court took out 3 of the 5 before Lennox shot him, and on the third evolution, he again eliminated 3 ground branch officers before Morgan and Pace both caught Court during a mag change and stitched him across the crotch with red paint cartridges. 2 more runs each saw Golf Sierra losing men against a single opposition, something that rarely happened during training when facing an entire team. After 90 minutes in the shoot house, Hightower finally announced the end of the session.
"Everybody take your weapons and gear back to the armory. Meet me in the break room in 30.
He nodded up to the safety officer, who had not left the catwalk for the duration of the drills. The safety officer just looked at Hightower, slowly shaking his head in disbelief. Clearly, he'd never seen anything like what he'd just witnessed either. Most of the men headed for the armory, but Court caught up to Zack.
"How about one more time, me running in the stack with you guys again? I'll get it tight."
Zack just shook his head.
"We're done for today."
Court just looked at him.
"So, you're the one ringing the bell then?"
Hightower didn't like this one bit. He raised a finger into the smaller man's face. Court did not back away from it, but neither did he adopt an aggressive posture himself. Zack said,
"Listen to me, Gentry. You have made your point that you are one hell of a CQB shooter. I haven't seen anybody do the shit you just did. Not in the teams, not on DevGrew, not here, not in any of the opposition I've faced. What we need, however, is not some loose gun running around our target area. We need a 6th man in our cohesive team."
Court knew Zack was right. He'd not proven himself as anything more than a singleton, and Golf Sierra wasn't the place for singletons. He said,
"I'll get there. I just need some practice. I've been doing some different things in the past few years. I'm rusty on my team tactics."
He added,
"But I won't be for long." "This isn't the place to learn, kid. Trust me, you've never seen anything like the hits we get sent on."
"You don't know what I've seen."
"I know you didn't see your pubes until about 5 years ago."
Court rolled his eyes.
I'm almost 26, for God's sake. What is the deal with my age? Do you fuckers need a sixth man to help you hit targets out there, or do you need a sixth man for bingo night at the retirement home?
Zack cracked a little smile at this, but he hid it quickly.
Drop your gear in the armory and go back to your hooch. I'm going to talk to the guys, then I'll send for you.
Court stood.
Fine. I'll be unpacking.
Zack said nothing as the new guy left the room. 2 hours after the men first kitted up in the shoot house, the five veterans of Golf Sierra sat in the break room on sub-level 2. Morgan said,
Boss, I gotta say it. That dude can move.
Pace said,
He's 15. Of course he can jump around. And he can put rounds on target, but can he work with a team?
Hightower took a swig from a bottle of water.
We need 2 weeks. Long days, long nights. But we can get him where we need him before we redeploy to the sandbox.
It was Redis who spoke up now.
Doesn't it bother you that we aren't allowed to know shit about who this guy is? Where he came from? How he learned to do what he did down in the shoot house? It creeps me the fuck out that this unknown shows up and schools us like that, and we're supposed to just take him in and not ask questions?
Hightower thought this over a moment.
I hear you. But the raw materials are there, no matter how the hell he came upon them. And there's something more important than his CQB abilities.
What's that, boss? Pace asked.
I don't know if you guys were paying attention, but I was. Forget about all the shucking and jiving he did. Did you look into that kid's eyes?
No one answered.
Well, I did. There's an almost feral look in there. He's a killer.
Zack spit dip into a cup. Then said,
A stone-cold fucking killer.
Lennox had been quiet. He nodded now.
Saw it too, boss.
We're all killers,
Morgan countered.
We aren't like him,
Hightower said flatly.
They won't tell us what he did in operations because he was an assassin.
Morgan sniffed.
The agency doesn't employ assassins,
Hightower said.
Sub Rosa shit. I guarantee that kid has been sent out on kill missions. Alone. It's in his eyes.
Redis said,
All the more reason I don't want him shouldering up behind me in the train. He's the breech bitch, or I'm not going out with him.
Fair enough. He's on point. I'll use him solo when I can. God knows we sometimes need an extra pair of eyes and a gun.
The team left, save for Hightower, and Redis leaned into Court's hooch and told him the TL wanted to talk to him in the break room. Court arrived at the table a minute later. He was icing an elbow he'd smacked when falling off the catwalk beam. Hightower said,
You pick up a boo-boo?
It's nothing.
Hightower nodded, then looked into the younger man's eyes.
How do you do it?
Do what?
Do what?
Zack mocked.
All that. I saw you firing on targets you didn't even have an angle on. I saw you reloading faster than anyone I've ever seen reload in my life. I watched you engage 3 oppo on 3 compass points, taking down 2 of them, twice.
Court put his elbows on the table, ignoring the injury to one of them.
What you saw? That's all I did between about the age of 8 to 18. My dad ran a shooting school in Florida. I worked there, pretty much 7 days a week, pretty much 8 hours a day, sometimes more, sometimes a lot more.
Zack's eyebrows furrowed.
I was playing baseball at that age.
Court shrugged.
I couldn't hit a baseball if my life depended on it. It was guns. It was CQB. It was moving and shooting. That's all it ever was for me. Until I got into the CIA.
And then?
Court wasn't going to talk about his work at the agency. Instead, he said,
Do you know what tachypsychia is?
Zack shook his head.
It's a neurological condition that alters the perception of time.
So?
For me, time seems to slow down when my adrenaline is up. I'm calmer under stress. I react more efficiently than most people. That and the training I've been given have turned me into what I am.
He shrugged.
Whatever that is.
Some CIA shrink told you all this?
Pretty much, yeah. But there's more to it. I can see shadows within shadows, recognize shapes and movement quickly. I don't know why.
Back in the shoot house, those guys you said I engaged without being able to see them?
I knew they were there. I cut the pie moving into the rooms. Caught just a sliver of an elbow of a man holding a gun, or a kneecap, saw the oppo before he saw me, and then moved my weapon to engage before putting myself in the line of fire. Doesn't always work. Hell, I got smoked a half dozen times today. But I'm fucking good at this. The older man looked him over for a long time.